Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 36. My name is Terry Frost, and I recorded the episode early this time around with Ian Triffitt from Sydney. We're both talking about an interesting movie called Detention from 2011. So I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then I'll play the hour or so of fun and games that I recorded with Ian. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast number 36. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I didn't pick the movie. My guest picked the movie, Ian Triffitt. Say hi, Ian.
Hi, Ian.
Hi, Ian. Yeah, I knew you'd go with that one. Thank you for picking the movie, which is Detention. I keep wanting to say Deterrence, which is another movie entirely, but it's Detention from 2011 and stars a whole bunch of people that are younger than both of us.
Yes, that's right. And you want to be careful when you look for Detention because there's about four films, and all of them, I think, are quite recent.
I did look up on Pirate Bay and typed in Detention. And got a whole listing of severe S&M videos.
Isn't that what we're talking? Oh, no, sorry, yes. I've got it, yes. Sorry, on the right track now, yes.
Yeah, so, there are a whole bunch of links to a whole bunch of kind of latex spanking videos, and I kind of had to narrow it down by putting in the year of the movie, 2011.
That's right. It's the latex spanking video with Dane Cook.
Yeah, well, that is a horrible thought, and I'm going to try to expunge it from my mind as soon as I possibly can. So, yeah, we won't talk about that just yet, though. We'll put that on to one side for the moment and talk about what have you been watching lately?
What have I been watching lately? I've become a bit of a television whore, I think. I think I'm watching...
You're selling televisions.
I've become a proletizer for television. I think there's amazing shows out there, and Hollywood's just not keeping up. And I think there's a steady flow of talent from Hollywood to television rather than what used to be the other way around. I mean, television was what you worked in until you got the attraction of Hollywood, and now it seems that stars and directors and things like that are giving up or just, I've got this project, I'm going to do it on television now because I can do it in all sorts of formats. Penny Dreadful. Have you been watching Penny Dreadful?
Yeah, I've been watching Penny Dreadful. I've watched the first two episodes.
Yeah, two episodes.
Yep, and the end of the second episode, I've already mentioned it, I think, on the previous Martian Drive-In where I said that the character that appears at the end of the second episode, without doing any spoilers, looks exactly like he does in the books. In the original book.
Yeah, it's very interesting, but it's full of Bond alumni.
It is. There's a whole bunch of things. There's Eva Green in there. There's Timothy Dalton in there. There is also Rory Kinnear.
Yep. Sam Mendes is one of the producers.
And the writer of Skyfall.
Yep. Writer of Skyfall as well. John, guy who's written a lot of stuff. I can't remember his name at present.
Okay, let me just see what I've got this guy for. Let's have a look at it, because that's why we have the internet while we're recording podcasts, so we can look things up. And I'm not going with the official movie site. Get off there. Let's have a look here. And this is fascinating listening for anybody who's listening.
tap, tap, tap.
John Logan.
John Logan, that's it. He's written a shitload of films, apparently, and not a load of shit films.
Well, which is a nice change from the usual.
It is.
But getting back to what you were saying about the interesting things happening on television. I think HBO's got a lot to do with that too. They really have kind of upped the game there.
It is.
There
was, but, sorry.
Yeah, what I was going to say is, and one of the things is that it used to be that people went to television when their movie careers died in the arse.
Yes, that's right.
And now people are going there because it's a chance to do short-term but slightly longer than movie projects.
Yeah.
That are of interest to them. So I'm looking at John Logan's Facebook page.
All right, okay. He
wrote the screenplay for Hugo.
Yep.
Rango. Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, which was great except for Johnny Depp. The remake of The Time Machine, but we'll forgive him that. The Aviator, Gladiator, and a movie that I like, which was a TV film called RKO 281.
I'd love to see that. That's the one with about the making of Citizen Kane, isn't it?
Yep, with Liev Schreiber as Orson Welles. It is around on DVD. If you look around, it's in the junk bins on DVD.
Yeah, because it's distributed by some crap company because the rights are cheap or something. There's some really good cable and TV movies that can be found in junk bins because no one likes them except people like us.
Well, I found a whole bunch of Ingmar Bergman's films in the $5 dump bin at my JB Hi-Fi because no one was buying. So I ended up with like Smiles on a Summer Night and things like that, and The Seventh Seal for $5 a pop. But getting back to Penny Dreadful, yeah, it's really good. Victorian England, it bears a lot of similarities to The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the original media, not the rather unfortunate movie. But I think it's a broad church, and I think they can definitely bring something interesting to it.
Well, they are, and they're not. The thing is, they're not signposting who each person is. They're just dropping clues until you go, oh, right. I mean, I hit myself over the head in the first episode when the Timothy Dalton character has a vision. And then I went, oh, so that's, oh, so he must be, of course.
Yep. And I think the Josh Hartnett character, my theory is he's a werewolf.
That's a pretty, I've read that speculation, yes.
Yeah. So we haven't found out yet.
No, but the set pieces, and it has Eva Green, and it has Eva Green at her most Eva Greenness, really.
Yep.
She's naked, she talks dirty, she shows her amazing acting range. I'm a big Eva Green fan, and so.
And she's got those intense eyes, which is awesome.
They're amazing eyes. They're absolutely fabulous, and I'm just glad there's a vehicle that really showcases her, because a lot of films she tends to not be used that well. Golden Compass was one where she is playing a great character, but the whole film was stifled by the approach of the director and the producers.
And I think there was a lot of influence by the studio to try to tone down the atheism.
That's right.
Which is very unfortunate because I've read all three books. Philip Pullman books, and they would make great movies.
They would. There's an excellent theatrical production, apparently, using puppets for the Damons, etc., that I would love to see. It was, and it was written by the guy who wrote a TV series called Utopia.
Which is very spooky. I think second season's coming out.
Yeah, the second season's coming out, and the Americans are going to desecrate it with their own version of it.
Yeah, because they don't understand English accents, I suppose.
I guess I don't know why. And it's so beautifully shot. It's one of the few TV series I'd like to have on Blu-ray.
I did mention it way back in one of the podcasts. And one of the interesting things I said about it was that it doesn't have the color palette for the whole series is intensified and not kind of skewed to one direction.
Yeah.
You know how when you see movies set in the 1950s, they always go with a sepia tone color palette. This one, they've kind of gone the other way and done a Douglas Sirk on it.
Yes.
And made it really, really intense, which is kind of cool and interesting.
Particularly when it works against the subject matter of it being a very dark conspiracy theory type series.
And I like that. I hope the second season they continue to do that, because that slightly intensified color palette really does work well.
Yeah. And some beautiful compositions in it, etc.
Yeah, it's Five Popular, every frame of it looks great.
A show that I got introduced to, and then I introduced another friend to, who just ripped through the entire season like I did. And this has a kind of connection with Detention, which is the film we're talking about.
Yeah.
Rick and Morty.
I don't know that
one. You don't know that one. Right. So it's Rick and Morty. It's called Rick and Morty. Yep. It's written by Dan Harmon and the guy that does all the voices for Rick and Morty. I'll just do my own little research.
And I can use some verb.
Yeah, Rick and Morty, Justin Roiland is the other creator. Voices include Chris Parnell, Spencer Grammer. A few voices you'd probably recognize, but yep. Dan Harmon is the creator of Community.
Yep.
And this is what he started doing. It was based on a little throwaway thing they did for Channel 7, Channel Z or something. They did some public access. He and his mates did this whole public access thing. And the basic joke that this comes from is, so imagine Back to the Future, and imagine Doc yep. Brown is actually an alcoholic okay. and potentially psychopathic. And imagine the, so that's Rick, and imagine Michael J. Fox is developmentally impaired.
Well, though I always thought that about Back to the Future anyway, yeah. but
But Rick is, as the series goes on, it's a cartoon series.
Yep.
It's made for adults. There are some very adult jokes in it.
Good.
But it's very, very good science fiction. It okay. has some amazing, and it does the Community thing of, this is, we're referring to this, but we're not duplicating it. We're just taking that idea and moving it in a different direction.
Okay.
Okay. So there's an episode where there's a series of alternate futures and one of them gets Cronenberg'd.
Ooh.
So they refer to it as the Cronenberg future because everyone has, it's like The Fly, except it's everyone.
Okay.
In various permutations, etc. So they're familiar with their genre history. It is like what I want Doctor Who to be now, basically.
But probably won't be.
But probably won't be. Though,
yeah.
I lost a lot of interest in Doctor Who. I just mm-hmm. kind of tried to keep up with it, but couldn't be bothered to a certain extent. Ben Wheatley, Ben Wheatley is directing the first two episodes of the Peter Capaldi Doctor. And do you know why that thrills me?
Tell me.
Ben Wheatley is the director of The Kill List. He's the director of Sightseers. I haven't seen his other two films. But he, certainly, like The Kill List, I call the reverse Wicker Man. And Sightseers is interesting because it's ostensibly a comedy. Kill List is not a comedy. It's one of the darkest possible films you could see. But it has elements in common with The Kill List. He has a real fascination with this idea of the matter of England and the pagan idea of what England was and that sort of bubbling to the surface in certain ways. And I was surprised to see it show up in Sightseers as well. And I think he's one of the genre directors that showed that has something really interesting to say, is bringing stuff to the table that we haven't seen for a while. He seems to be very influenced by the 60s, 70s trend in British horror.
Oh, cool.
Of the partial idea. Sorry.
Yeah, you mentioned The Wicker Man.
Yeah.
I did that for the radio gig.
Cool.
Yeah, I introduced Liz Travaskis to it, and she got blown away. She loved it.
It's one of my wife's favorite films. She's not a horror fan by any means at all, but she just loves The Wicker Man, and I had to get the special burnt wooden box edition with the addition of the Roger Corman footage on 16 mil, I think it is, spliced in, and you realize there's an entire day taken out of the action of the film. Once you see that, it makes a lot more sense, even though it's...
Yeah, that's with all the Gently Johnny stuff.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Which is lovely.
But it's such a wonderful film. And Ben Wheatley is obviously... I mean, he's weird because his background is comedy.
Yeah.
And he's doing High Rise, I think, the adaptation of the J.G. Ballard novel.
Which is getting pretty dark there. I mean, the only thing I can compare that to is there's a French film from the 70s called Thembrock. Which has got a very similar.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, with Michelle Piccoli.
Yes.
Very similar to that kind of thing. I really should do Thembrock for a podcast because.
It's certainly a film that deserves more exposure, I think. I saw it at the Valhalla. In fact, if you saw it there, we were probably.
I saw the Wicker Man at the State Theatre in Sydney when on first release.
Oh, wow. That's excellent.
That's back when the State Theatre in Sydney was showing softcore porn and horror movies.
Wow.
Back in that 1970s patch when they didn't know what to do with the cinema that large and grand, where you could basically film Scaramouche in the cinema.
Yeah.
They didn't know what to do with it. So things like The Wicker Man were showing up there. And I was shocked when I first saw The Wicker Man because of the ending, because it wasn't an ending you saw in cinema up to that stage.
Yeah.
But we're drifting a little bit. But that's okay.
So the final thing I want to plug, it's up to its last episode, which I haven't watched yet. But I think there are two shows that I think are real achievements in terms of what you can do in television and where genre filmmaking is today. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the one I rave about to people is Orphan Black. I don't know if you've seen it.
I've seen it, but I've kind of got to weed out things. Because I'm doing two podcasts, I'm doing basically one a week, and I'm doing the radio gig.
That's right.
I've got to be selective, but please tell me about it.
Admittedly, I bring in one of the things that fascinates me about Orphan Black is you have one actress playing several characters, often in the same scene together.
Yeah.
To the extent where they're actually pouring drinks for each other or attacking each other, etc.
Yeah.
And you get a weird dissonance when you're watching it because you go, you're responding to the events. And then there's this catch up thing, which is going, how did they actually do that? Because I'm looking
you get that value added for it.
Yeah. And, when you find out how they actually did it, it is quite astonishing and something that can only be done, due to two things. One is just technology using computer-controlled cameras to duplicate camera movements, which I think Doug Trumbull was the first to come up with in Star Wars.
I think he pretty much was.
Yeah.
Yeah, him and Dykstra, I think, working...
That's right, John Dykstra. And the other thing is the Tatiana Maslany's performances, where she has immersed herself in the characters to such an extent that you can have one character passing themselves off as another character.
Yeah. It gets a bit labyrinthine.
It gets a bit labyrinthine. Just because I work with actors, I mean, that's the thing I'll plug when we get to the plug bit. I know how difficult that is. And I know how amazing that is to sustain for a full series, let alone two series.
It must be mentally exhausting for
it. It must be.
Yeah.
But one of the things that struck me about the show is it's one of the few science fiction shows where the amazing technology is pretty much off screen.
Which is a bit like Person of Interest, where you do see things from the AI's viewpoint, but most of it is off screen.
I must catch up with Person of Interest. I've only seen one episode of it, and I've heard a lot about it, and it's about a field that interests me, which is privacy.
Third season, shit gets incredibly real in it.
Yeah. Well, I'll take that on board as the next thing to follow. Oh, I've been trying to catch up with Arrow.
Yeah, I've seen the most recent season of Arrow. And Arrow, I gave it the first season.
Yep.
And the second season isn't disappointing. And the third season, they're getting a bit more into the superhero stuff.
Yeah.
With the spin-off of The Flash, of course.
I was initially disappointed with it because I'm starting to develop a severe allergy to protagonists who kill and torture people, particularly when they're meant to be heroes. But as it went on, I noticed that they were actually dealing with that as an issue. And
the first season, he was a vigilante killer.
Yeah.
Second season, he had an epiphany and became who we want him to be.
Yeah. So that's fine. But, sorry.
Yep.
Again, that's digressing.
It's a podcast. We're allowed to.
So, Orphan Black. I can understand you not being into it, but absolutely amazing production behind it that is effectively invisible.
Yep.
The other one is Hannibal.
Sally's watching that, but I'm not.
One of the most amazing things about it is it's made by NBC.
Okay.
It's made by an American free-to-air network. It looks like a cable show. It's astonishingly acted, directed, written. Every time you think they can't appall you, they will come up with something that you go, Yes, that's probably the grossest thing I've seen since the last episode. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I remember a couple of weeks ago, Sal started talking to me about how gross something on Hannibal was.
Yeah.
And she said the guy was getting fed his own face. And I went, yeah, Mason Verger, I've seen it in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And she didn't know how I knew who Mason Verger was.
Yeah, because they're doing this thing where they're referencing the books and the action of the books and the flashbacks, which Mason Verger shows up in Hannibal. I've only read the first two books, but he appears in one of the later books.
I think it was Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman played him in the movie. But they're also moving in different directions. So apart from Hannibal and Will Graham, no one else is safe, even if they are mentioned in the books. And one of the my tolerance towards gore has lowered since I got older. And it wasn't it's a bit of a conflict with being a horror fan, but I prefer films that convey dread more than disgust. Mm. Basically, that's the approach I take. When I first heard about Hannibal, I thought, oh, well, because I tried to watch Criminal Minds or something like that, and I just found them very reactionary. You know, we have a serial killer, we just have to, you know, make them extinct and not have to worry about the social forces or the environment that actually created the serial killer. They're just monsters.
Yeah, the reason TV doesn't do that is most serial killers are instigated by some form of religious overkill.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's something that particularly American TV wants to have to deal with.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
But also... They depict the most appalling things, and the detectives aren't that affected by it. Hannibal deals with the consequences of the violence that the protagonists both commit and have committed on them or witness. And I was staggered at how responsible I felt it was. And so it had that dread thing for me going, that I wasn't watching it for the gore. I was watching it for the psychological thriller aspect of it, of how far can Hannibal, because it's a prequel at the moment to Manhunter, Red Dragon. So they don't know.
I still
know.
Like Brian Cox as Hannibal.
Oh, Brian Cox. Brian Cox is the best of the movie Hannibals that I've seen. Because he didn't oversell it at all. And
it's all internalized.
That's
a lot more. I mean, Anthony Hopkins was great as a kind of flamboyant character.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of things he did there that are really great. Like at the end of Silence of the Lambs, where he's walking away from the phone booth, he's walking like a predatory cat.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff I can appreciate. But yeah, I mean, I do like Brian Cox in anything. I don't give it.
He's wonderful.
Sorry,
you just reminded me one of the things I saw recently. So we were trying to find a Bob Hoskins film to watch. And we pulled out Who Framed Roger Rabbit because, of course, everyone else was doing Long Day,
Long Good Friday.
Long Good Friday, yep. Which I don't happen to have anyway. Yes, it's a gap in my collection. There are many. And we decided to go with his performance of Iago in Othello, in the BBC Shakespeare of Othello. And we started watching it, and his performance of Iago is great. We actually saw Rory Kinnear, again, harking back, playing Iago in an Adrian Lester Othello.
I remember seeing the reviews of that one on the BBC website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Othello is played by Anthony Hopkins in blackface.
Okay.
And it's really hard to deal with.
That reminds me of an old Morecambe and Wise thing where Eric Morecambe was doing Othello in blackface as a minstrel.
Yeah, yeah.
Just taking the piss out of Anthony Hopkins and Laurence Olivier doing it.
And
it wasn't really a racist thing. It was taking the piss out of these actors who black up.
Gary McDonald did it as Norman Gunston.
Yeah.
Had half his face blacked up. It was a Tommy Cooper routine, I think, that he duplicated.
Yeah.
Playing both Iago and Othello. But yeah, Anthony Hopkins blacked up was a bit difficult. It was like a deep tan, you know, it wasn't a minstrel thing. But after all the Jonah of Tonga stuff, I just, yeah. Different time.
Yeah, it's not something you can get away with now, and there are so many great actors
of color. That's right.
That it's not something that's necessary at all. I mean, it does take one play out of somebody's Shakespearean repertoire.
Yeah.
But like a lead actor's repertoire. But, you know, you'll get to Lear eventually.
He will. So
what do you want to...
Anyway, Hannibal is excellent. Is excellent. Lawrence Fishburne is great in it as Jack Crawford.
Mads Mikkelsen.
Mads Mikkelsen is amazing. It's very subtle what he does. Gillian Anderson's in it briefly.
Okay.
In a number of episodes is a very important character.
She's had a lot of work done lately, hasn't she?
Yeah. she's working very hard at the moment. I'm amazed by all the stuff she's doing. But I am really impressed by how they've kept it up. They've done the thing in season two where it gets a little bit wilder.
Okay, cool.
But it hasn't. It's not turned into self-parody just yet. It hasn't.
It hasn't
jumped the shark just yet. But you kind of hear the sort of motorbike revving up in the background, and just. I haven't watched the last episode yet. But the Mason Verger episode, and there was an interesting discussion with Brian Fuller about doing that episode and how they got it past Standards and Practices, because they were really worried about, and apparently Standards and Practices had no problem with the way they did the scene. They did have a problem with a dream sequence where Hannibal's throat gets cut and there's a huge blood spurt. They just said, blood spurts are going on for a little bit long. Better cut that. And I'm thinking, wow, compared to all the other stuff that goes on in Hannibal, that's what you're worried about?
I think that particularly with network television, they're starting to expand it a little bit because they're going to lose market share unless they take it where cable's going.
Yes, that's right.
And I think that they're aware of that. And there's that symbiotic relationship between Standards and Practices and all of the censorship people and the networks that they're moving things in a more generous direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, as you say, with HBO, they're kind of forced to. I'll put in a recommendation for a book for The Revolution Will Be Televised by Alan Sepinwall.
Okay.
Alan Sepinwall is an American TV critic who is now kind of like the Roger Ebert of TV criticism. And he produced a book, and he produced it really quickly. I got it for Christmas in 2012.
Yeah.
And what it is, every chapter describes the genesis of one of the new TV shows. Like the first chapter is about Oz, HBO, and how HBO really amped up Oz to really test the boundaries of what they could do on television. And went so far that they actually cut back. But it goes, so it, and it has interviews with all the as many of the creative staff as they could find. So it covers Deadwood, it covers West Wing, I think, it covers Friday Night Lights, it covers The Shield, it covers The Wire, Lost,
okay.
Battlestar Galactica, and it's fascinating about Breaking Bad, how, like, Vince Gilligan talking about Breaking Bad, never thinking it would get to a full season.
Right.
He thought, we'll only be able to shoot four episodes of this, and then they'll pull the plug.
So you might as well just go to town with it.
Yeah, that's right. And how they were allowed massive, amazing amounts of creative freedom that you don't get in Hollywood. David Milch, while he was doing Deadwood, was making up dialogue while the cameras were rolling.
Okay.
I can't imagine any Hollywood production allowing that kind of thing to happen.
Casablanca did.
I guess it would. I'm talking now when it's micromanaged within an inch of its life.
Absolutely, yeah. And which brings up the other big news at the moment, the change in Ant-Man.
I just read that half an hour ago or so. You really have to think, well, my context, the way I thought of why the Marvel films are doing so well is that they haven't got in the way of the directors. They've started to employ more distinctive directors with a particular style, like Shane Black. I couldn't believe Shane Black was directing Iron Man 3.
And it worked really well. It took Iron Man in a different direction, which is fantastic. Yeah.
Well, he has such a chemistry. There's an amazing chemistry he has as a director with Robert Downey Jr. He really accentuates all the things that make Robert Downey Jr. a hypnotic screen presence. But also doing the Bond, it wasn't really a Bond credit sequence. It was like a 70s cop show sequence that just tied it all together. And it was set at Christmas, and it had a smart-ass little kid, and it was really a Shane Black film as much as it was a Marvel film. And I thought, this is a really interesting direction for them to go in.
Yeah. The big Shane Black film that people tend to forget, which I love.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
I do like that one, but I actually did that one on the radio too.
Oh, right.
But is The Last Boy Scout with Bruce Willis.
I will have to give that another try because I have watched it twice and I have very limited memories of it. I can remember it has the great scene of Bruce Willis basically getting out of being killed by telling a very funny joke.
Yeah, doing the your mama joke.
Yeah.
How fat is your wife?
Yeah.
Doing that kind of, there's also the really great bit at the start with Billy Blanks in the football field in the rain.
Yes, yeah.
And I like it. I think it's really great, and there's a redemption arc, and I always like redemption arcs in movies.
Right.
But yeah, getting back to Ant-Man for a sec, Edgar Wright, I don't know what the history is behind it. I think one of the things I've heard about it is that Edgar Wright films things with not a lot of coverage.
Right.
And the studio had a big problem with that. Not the studio. Well, in a sense, Marvel didn't have a problem with it. But
Marvel are owned by Disney now.
Yes, the suits at Disney are starting to flex their muscles.
Yeah, that's very, very probable. Because while there seems to be a kind of Marvel aesthetic, the films themselves have been terribly distinctive.
Yeah. Captain America, The Winter Soldier is like a 1970s conspiracy thriller.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And Thor had sort of the cod Shakespearean thing that Kenneth Branagh brought to it.
Mm.
And the original Captain America, which was my favorite Marvel movie, I think, until the sequel. Joe Johnson, who I've loved, working.
Did Rocketeer.
And I always thought Rocketeer should have had all the sequels they were preparing for it.
I think Rocketeer was about 15 years too early.
It was. Yeah. It really was. But, to see him return to that milieu and just that love of the anachronistic technology and that kind of thing and just the the design sense was wonderful. I mean, maybe we'll see it again in, was it Agent Peggy Carter? Or Peggy Carter, yeah. Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever.
Yeah, which is really weird because you're going to have a TV series there with the protagonist you know is going to end up senile in a nursing home.
Yeah.
Which is going to be an odd kind of thing to do.
Well, I mean, Hannibal, you know that Hannibal's not going to die.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that willing suspension of disbelief kind of thing there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But, I like Edgar Wright's stuff. I think Scott Pilgrim didn't work for me because I was out of the demographic for it.
I like Scott Pilgrim a lot. I think I'm not saying I know some people. Well, I get the feeling people misunderstand his character, that they don't realize it's a redemption film because he's an asshole most of the way through the film. And people go into it expecting they're meant to sympathize with him, and they don't. And so they think that's the film's fault, whereas it's what the film's trying to do. And it did have that lovely sense of adolescence.
Yeah, that ignorance of adolescence thing.
Yeah. But just the sort of the operatic manifestation of power that, you know, used to be the superhero thing with Spider-Man, but what Brian O'Malley did in the comic book is he used video games as the metaphor for overcoming obstacles and receiving rewards at the end and plugging away.
And that, of course, passed through to the movie as well.
Yes.
I think the fact that I don't like Michael Cera is probably...
That would have a hell of a lot to do with it.
Yeah, it could well do. But yeah, so I'll say a little bit about what I've been watching. I finished the last one of these podcasts literally 5 hours ago.
Right.
So the two things I've watched since then were William Castle's Mr. Sardonicus from the 1960s.
I really want to see that. The reason is that was the first Famous Monsters of Filmland I picked up with the Basil Gogo picture of Mr. Sardonicus, and I wanted to know what the film was. And I read about it, and I thought, I have to see this, and never seen it.
But it's out there.
Yep.
And it's got Oscar Homolka in it, and I like him as a character actor.
Right.
And, I watched it, and William Castle mugging and being over the top and kind of like being a really obnoxious version of Alfred Hitchcock.
Did you know there is an arc of the Wise Guy TV series devoted to
Mr. Sardonicus.
Yeah.
I did pick that up when I was doing my Mr. Sardonicus research for no good reason. And I saw The Thing with Two Heads with Ray Milland and Rosie Gooner in it, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally silly and over the top and stupid, but it's perfect 1970s drive-in fare.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I watched that because I'd just done, for the last podcast I did, X the Man with X-Ray Eyes.
Oh, yes.
Which I've only just uploaded the podcast.
Right.
And I thought, I'm going to see Ray Milland's other big, dumb movie. And The Thing with Two Heads, so I watched that. And it's a lot of fun. They crash a lot of cop cars. I thought I was watching the Blues Brothers there for a while. But they do prang a whole bunch of cop cars and a whole bunch of paddocks for no good reason, just to fill out the running time of the movie.
Didn't Joe Dante have footage of a helicopter explosion, which Roger Corman wanted to sort of put in every film possible?
Yeah, this wasn't a Roger Corman. It was an AIP, but it wasn't a Corman.
Right, yeah.
But it's got that same aesthetic about it, which is kind of really cool. And I like both of those. And I'll let you know the next thing I'm going to watch, which is something I haven't done before in a podcast. I decided I want to cleanse the palate a little bit of horror stuff. So I'm just waiting for this to load so I can talk about it, because I always have a kind of relaxed movie after I do a podcast.
Yep.
And in this case, it's going to be a 1960s Eurospy movie from 1968 called Assignment to Kill, starring Patrick O'Neill.
Wow.
So that's going to be my go-to movie for after the podcast. But, so that's pretty much what I've been watching. Television-wise, Penny Dreadful, I've been watching that. I've been watching a lot of Louis C.K.'s TV series, Louis.
That's something I want to catch up with, really like it. I really like what he's doing. And
a couple of years ago we saw Louis C.K.
live. Wow.
Friday, 2nd of September 2011, I got the ticket right in front of me.
Ah.
So we saw him do live, and seeing somebody who is the best in the world at stand-up, like one of the top five or six people in the world, is an amazing experience. Yeah. Just seeing the how comfortable he is with it. It's like watching a ninja.
Yes.
Do his stuff.
Yeah.
It's just at that incredibly high level. So I've been watching that a little bit, and I've been watching Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown, where he basically, it's not particularly about food, but he travels to interesting parts of the world and goes into them. He goes to Russia and talks about how Putin has totally rorted the Olympics.
Right.
He goes to Mexico and talks about the killings down there with the drug cartels.
Wow.
And it's a really great series. It's nothing to do with genre stuff, and I'm putting it in the podcast anyway because I think people should see it. And it's a very well-rounded series. He's doing it for CNN. It's not actually for his usual Food Network things. It's a series he's doing for CNN where he travels around, talks to lots of different people, and doesn't whitewash what he sees.
Right.
So it's a perfect travel show for people who like reality.
It's a travel show for places you don't want to go to.
Well, you might want to go there, but you might want to take an armored car.
Yes.
So there's that. Plug what you need to plug.
Okay, well, I'm based in Sydney.
My hometown.
And I have created and sort of direct and produce an improvisation show that's on one Sunday in each month at King Street Theatre. Now, you've all seen impro shows before, but this is different. It's called Twitter, and all the improvisation comes from tweets from the audience in real time. They're projected at the back of the stage, and so the cast have, in some cases, they take 5 seconds to work out who everyone is. In other cases, they just launch straight into it. We have people tweeting pictures that they have to respond to. We had we actually had, I think, the Pinhead from Tobe Hooper's
Hellraiser. Oh, no, okay. Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Show up as one of the pictures. And at the end of the show, we just open it to the audience and we have a scene going on and the audience can tweet what they like for cast to respond to and integrate within the scene. And it's been going for about, I think this is actually the third year. We did 2011 Sydney Fringe. We've gone to the Adelaide Fringe. We've now got a home at King Street Theatre in Newtown. The next show is June the 22nd, 5 p.m., $25. You can find out more about the show at tweeter.com. That's tweeter.com.
Cool. I wish I'd known that because I was up at King Street at Easter.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because we went up to visit the family and do other things, and we headed up through King Street, went up to Gould's Book Arcade.
Oh, yes, yes. I was following your Facebook post thinking, we should actually intersect probably.
We'll do it next time I go up.
Yeah.
I'm going up in October because I'm giving away my sister at her wedding.
Right.
So I'll tell you about what happened the last time I did that, which I'm not going to put on the podcast.
Sure.
But yeah, it's we'll have to do a meet up there, but Newtown's a beautiful place and everything's there.
It's interesting because it's several distinct, you've got the kind of sort of hipster, you've got the kind of grungy industrial area coming up from Sydney Uni, and then it becomes kind of hipster central.
Yeah.
Then there's the sort of gay community and the more hardcore drinking holes around the station. But as you go down towards St. Peter's, there's marvellous little odd shops that open up. Pussycat Kill Kill.
Yeah, we went past that. It wasn't open when we went past.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Someone wanted to go back to it.
Yeah, yeah. There would have been some nice stuff in
and
there.
Tattoo shops and all sorts of
things. That's right.
I used to live in Newtown. You know the pointy building right near the station? There's that pointy building. Looks like a miniature Flatiron building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with three sides. I used to live above in the top, in the two floors above that.
Wow.
Right in there. Couldn't live there. Nobody can live there because it's so crazy noisy 24 hours a day.
It would be.
You can't sleep. But we ended up with this enormous flat at a very small price. Nobody telling us that you can't live there.
It was unlivable, yeah. I lived on in a flat above Enmore Road, above a chicken shop in Enmore Road, and that got pretty crazy late weekend nights with drunks stumbling home, crying out as if their home would respond to them so they could work out where it was.
Mm.
But yeah.
I was actually walking through the back streets in Newtown once many, many years ago, and I stumbled, well, I didn't stumble upon, but I happened upon a blind guy who'd been looking for his address for 6 hours.
Oh, man.
So I found his address and we got him to the right house. And, yeah, the poor guy was at desperate ends and nobody would help him.
Wow.
And I'm not usually a Samaritan kind of person. I'm as selfish as anyone. But, yeah, 6 hours, I thought, geez, that must be horrible. And I kind of went up the street, went around a corner and stood there with my eyes shut for about a minute just to kind of imagine what it was like.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the poor guy, he was at his wit's end, and nobody was there to help him.
Oh, that's terrible. And Newtown's a terrible place for that to happen because it's full of small streets.
Yeah. He just got disoriented.
Yeah. So all you have to do is just turn in the wrong direction or skip a street or whatever, and you'll be completely lost. Okay. A recommendation, I don't know if you went to Hum Records. When you're in Newtown?
We went past Hum Records.
Oh, you should have gone in. They have a great DVD collection. They have a lot of discounted titles for $5. But
I think somebody dragged me away from that.
Oh, yes. I
think that may have happened.
I often have that happen to me. And Better Read Than Dead, which is next door to the Dendy, is a great bookstore as well.
Yeah, I think I picked up something there, but I can't remember what because I picked up so many books that day.
King Street's sort of taken over from Glebe. Glebe still has Glebe books, but I used to live at the bottom of Glebe Point Road, and I used to love walking up to it. That was when the Valhalla had their $2.50 Saturday matinees.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I lived in Glebe once upon a time, too.
You got your warm cordial and a few jaffers, and you got a cereal and a cartoon and a film.
Yeah. Movie-related story about the Valhalla. It's this old cinema, for people who don't know, that was in Sydney at Glebe. Originally, it was open to show the Rocky Horror Theatre show. It was the first thing I remember seeing around there. And I went there on a midnight session to see Plan 9. It was Robot Monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space, midnight session at the Valhalla. This is just as VHS tapes were coming in. So, you know, you get all of the kind of cult movie crowd turning up there for a midnight session. And some of them are a little bit pissed. They've been in the pubs around Glebe. And they're a little bit pissed. So go in there, get my seat, which is about 8 rows back in the center, a good position to watch a movie in the cinema. And the guy sitting dead center in the front row puked. And this wasn't just puking. This was, you know, Monty Python level of vomit. And this is about 5 minutes before the movie's about to start. And so all of the ushers go down there with mops and things like that, but there's this horrible stench of vomit in the front of the cinema. And so the weird thing about it was all of us saw the movie with a semicircular ring of empty seats at the front. And, you know, the movies weren't that bad, but it was just a nightmarish thing to see.
Oh, gosh.
So there you go. We brought it back to genre cinema at last.
We have.
I just mean that it looks like Clapton's going to ask out Ione, which makes about as much sense as that stupid movie Torque. Give me your iPod, salad eater.
Life sucks. Forget about genocide, poverty, and political corruption. What could possibly be on my girl mind other than prom? Who gave Riley the permission to have the hots for Clapton?
What does the future hold for Clapton Davis?
If you're gonna get your limbs ripped off by the school gorilla, find a more worthy charity than Ione.
Thank God that's not me.
Ione is an old soul trapped in a very painfully hot cheerleader body.
Clapton Davis, you are more concept than reality.
Your classmate, Taylor Fisher, was murdered in her bedroom this morning. was just attacked.
Sure you were, honey.
Are you guys accusing me of something?
There's a killer in Grizzly Lake who is affiliated with people at my school. Detention is in the library. It goes from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. That's right through prom.
It can't be any of us. We're not anguished enough. Our generation has had no major struggle.
What about 9/11?
Afghanistan.
Katrina.
Heath Ledger.
What? Too soon.
This attacker you're describing, Ms. Jones? Sounds just like that horror film.
Cinderella.
Scream.
It's not the end of the world. It's just high school.
Taught you how to make a snuff porno, Lady Gaga.
Okay, so Detention. You brought this one to me. 2011 film stars Josh Hutcherson, who is in The Hunger Games, amongst other things, and was in Zathura as one of the kids. As you said, Dane Cook, and a bunch of young, good-looking people. So tell me what you like about this film.
I think it's one of the few films I've seen in recent years that just seems to be filled with the joy of what you can do in genre cinema.
Oh, cool.
And just an immense sense of play, in that you really did not know what the film was going to throw at you next. It's very interesting to sort of read reviews of Detention as they try to make sense of what it is, because it's sold. It can be quite hard to find because it's sold as a horror film. It has the marking, the packaging shows
a skull and blood and things like that.
So you're probably not even aware that it's a comedy for a start. And if you think it's a comedy, you may think it's like Scary Movie or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I read a review that really highlighted what it was about Detention, that you have a film with where the four main characters are each from a different 80s, 90s genre film.
Yeah.
So you have
I'm going to try to do a little bit of a pricey on it before you go any further. Sure. It's going to be difficult. The one from IMDb says, as a killer named Cinderella stalks a student body at the high school in Grizzly Lake, a group of co-eds band together to survive while they're all serving detention, which actually doesn't say anything at all. There's another one here saying, this comedy horror movie is about a group of teens that go to Grizzly Lake High School. When one of their classmates is killed by someone dressed up as Cinderella, a character from a popular horror movie, they are all under suspicion. But when they get detention, they try to work out who it is. Now, that's very, very raw bones and doesn't tell you anywhere where this movie goes.
And detention doesn't occur until the actual detention doesn't occur until three quarters of the way through the film.
Yeah. So one of the things I liked about it, because, as I said, I watched it 1.5 times, I've told you that. It breaks the fourth wall right from the start.
Yes.
I'm Taylor Fisher. And I'm a bitch. Beauty, intelligence, talent, charisma, hooba stank. What? They're good. Indie rock trends do move fast. Today my alarm is set to the drums. But by the time you actually watch this, they'll be headlining a toilet in Toledo. With mops.
Hey bitch, that's not cool.
Eat cock!
Hello, Taylor. Don Waters, again. We made out behind the pizza pit. You tasted the deep dish.
Not deep enough. Get out of the bathroom. You're ruining my life, you fucking ecstasy baby!
Where the most popular girl in school is talking to the screen, and it's got a whole bunch of superimposed titles on things in a manner not unreminiscent of things like Fight Club and Scott Pilgrim as well, where she's telling what she likes and what her acronym for bitch is.
Yes.
And all this kind of thing. And she's yelling at her mum because she doesn't want to have breakfast with bread in it and all this kind of stuff. And then she's not in the rest of the movie.
Yes.
except as a plot point. I'm not going to give away anything but that. So we then meet Riley, who's the kind of protagonist, who's a clumsy girl vegetarian with her ligament cast at the start of the film. And she's in love with one of the other guy, one of the guys in her class, though she doesn't really know it, a guy called Clapton Davis. And everyone's got weird names in this movie.
Yeah.
Played by Josh Hutcherson, who's about 3 foot tall and is the kind of 3 foot tall guy in Hunger Games. And her best friend's name is Ione, who is another reference to 1990s movies, who basically only makes references to 1990s pop culture.
Yes.
Yes. A teenage girl, 17 or 18 years old, who only makes 1990 references. But there's a reason why. And that kind of creeps up on us in a way. So basically, to summarize the movie, it's a slasher, science fiction, horror, teen comedy. Have I missed anything?
You left out Body Swap.
Yeah, there's a Body Swap. There's a bit of Freaky Friday going on there as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's a mashup between The Breakfast Club, Freaky Friday, Back to the Future, Bill and Ted, and The Fly.
Yep. And that makes it hard to define. it gets a 5.8 on IMDb because I think mashing together so many genres really is a difficult thing to get past certain people.
Yes.
And Dane Cook plays the school principal. Now, I've got a problem with Dane Cook, and I'll tell you what it is. Dane Cook got his career started by pinching other comedians' material. People, he stole from Joe Rogan, he stole from Louis C.K.
Yes. Isn't there an episode of Louis C.K. where he confronts him?
Yeah. That? Yeah, he does.
I really do have to see that, because years ago, back in the past, in the 1980s, I used to do stand-up comedy and have my material ripped off. So I'd be interested to know how that played out.
Yeah, and in comedy circles, he basically is the leper with the least fingers.
Yes, that's right.
So, and he doesn't do badly in this movie, but just the fact that it's Dane Cook kind of sported for me in, as far as he's concerned. But
because he's Dane Cook. It could be really anyone playing the principal. It's not an ostensibly... who was the actor who was in Ghostbusters who got done for... Was it Ghostbusters? No.
Jeffrey Jones.
Jeffrey Jones, yes. It's the Jeffrey Jones character.
Yeah.
Wasn't he? Ferris Bueller. Sorry, that's the one I'm thinking of. Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, Shanley Caswell does a good job as Riley.
Oh, yes. Kind of
is the focal point of the film. Josh Hutcherson's in it, but he was also one of the producers, so I think it may have been one of his projects. And the director of this film, Joseph Kahn, if you look at his IMDb, which is really interesting, he mostly did Britney Spears music videos.
Yeah. He did one film before Detention
Talk,
which he actually references, which is referenced in Detention as a pretty awful film.
Yep. But, I'll just go through some stuff. Oh, he's done a couple of Eminem videos, which is probably why he's got that Canadian rapper guy in there who talks like Eminem.
Oh, yes.
In the debating team.
Yeah.
He did an Enrique Iglesias music video, Backstreet Boys, Blink 182.
Oh,
and 50 Cent. So basically, mostly what he does is videos.
Yeah.
Which is kind of kooky, but I like this film too. It does, watching it the second time, you realize that every little quirky thing that happens throughout the start of the film for the first 45 minutes of the film is a plot point that's going to pay off somewhere.
Yes.
I mean, there's lots of them. There's the fact that I only references the 1990s.
Yep.
There's the fact that one of the principal has a scar on the side of his face.
Yeah.
And what else is there? There's a few other plot points there. The bear.
The bear is
They've got a stuffed bear. Yeah. They've got a stuffed bear in the main hall of the school. And there's a story that somewhere in the 1990s, some girl gave the bear a blowjob. And that's referenced in there and has a payoff.
Yes.
In the movie as well, which is really, really cool. It's very textured and layered and recursive, this movie.
I think a lot of people just didn't know what to make of it. One of the most interesting reviews I read about, which was a negative review, was from the AV Club. And I think it was actually Nathan Rabin, who should be more sympathetic towards what Detention was doing. But he just thought, it's doing too much. It's trying too hard. It's overwhelming.
Yep.
Now, a friend of mine who has his own movie review site, moviesandbacon.com, I'll get a kickback from him, is a big community fan as well as I. The community, the sadly now deceased Situation Comedy.
Yep.
And that was his comparison to Detention, because it had the same love of genre, but also showing what genre can highlight about experiences. I mean, all the films most of the films that Detention draws from are all set around high schools or teenage characters and their experiences.
Yeah.
And it's just, intensifies them, puts them all in a blender, but it doesn't come out bland. It comes out with huge chunks that somehow all fit together by the end of the film. And
it's incredibly inventive, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. And that's where I got the sense of joy from it, because you don't often get film. That's kind of what I like about Edgar Wright, what he can do in a cut, and that he's got this big toolbox to play with, and he just tries stuff out. And Detention has that same kind of cinematic energy that you don't really get so much now. People are too busy trying to emulate stuff they've seen before.
Yeah.
Or they're doing the Michael Bay eye fuck thing where it's all about spectacle. It's all about just smashing your brain into the back of the eyes. So that you can't go, well, wait a minute, she was nowhere near that point at the time, and where did this truck come from, and all those kinds of questions you start asking yourself when, Detention shows kind of a middle way where you can talk about genre, you can use tropes from genre, but you can express something new with them.
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun too. I mean, it doesn't take itself seriously. It treats the intelligence of the audience with a bit of respect, which I like.
It's so dense, though. Mm. Trying to catch all the dialogue, all the stuff that's going on in the background as well, which again is important. All the twists it does on the particular genres of the whole story with the quarterback. The quarterback being, you're thinking the quarterback is a villain, and then you find out his incredibly tragic backstory.
Yeah, and there are those little chapter headings that give you a bit of backstory and advance the plot along the way as
well. Yeah, that's
There's
right.
There that's extraneous.
It reminded me of a film called Volcano High.
Okay.
Which
is that a Japanese
one? It's Thai, I think.
Oh, Thai. Okay, sorry. It's Asian. Anyway. Yeah.
Which did a similar kind of thing. Volcano High was kind of like Harry Potter, but in a martial arts school.
And that kind of harks back to things like Pulp Fiction, which has those kind of headlines as well.
Yes.
Like the Bonnie situation.
Yeah.
And things like that from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, and I just wish movies would do more of that kind of, I don't know, extra textual stuff.
Yeah, there's other groovy stuff in there too. The titles.
Oh, the titles are great. The titles.
They're incredibly inventive titles where they appear on naturally appearing things in a school.
Yeah.
As the camera kind of zooms and pans between things. which is really kind of cool. And then
ends on the director's name being flushed down a toilet.
Yeah, which is a little bit, humbling for the director, I suppose. Yeah, and I mean, it's got a couple of places where it could have gone really dark, like the worst suicide attempt ever. But it didn't. It plays it, and then takes it in a different direction.
Yeah.
And
why at it's the hard end, to give up being a vegetarian.
Yeah, particularly when dismembered parts fall into barbecue.
That's right.
And it's a nice little film. It is very inventive and a lot of fun. And you get these tiny little mysteries that arise, like why does the stuffed grizzly bear have a magnetic field around it?
Yes.
And why does Ione only make 1990s references? And
who is that guy who's been in detention for 20 years?
For 18 years or something, yeah. And why is he carving things into the desktop?
Yeah.
And all of those have payoffs.
Yeah.
Everything that has a payoff. Why is the principal such an asshole?
Yeah.
And there's a payoff on that, and there's a reason why he's such an asshole too. It's a beautifully textured and layered film. And didn't make any money at all, and didn't cost a terrible amount to make, about a $10 million budget.
Yeah.
And but I think it's got cult movie all over it.
It has, and it's not, but it. So many cult movies nowadays feel like they're trying to be cult movies, feel like we're just making this for, so you can say that you've seen a film with this element in it or whatever. Human Centipede, I guess, is a classic example. That film wouldn't exist without
that being film left a bad taste in my mouth.
Well, you should have been at the start of the centipede, I guess.
It's always good to be the front of the centipede.
Yeah,
definitely. By the way, you mentioned a negative review in AV Club. You there?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a negative review in the Onion AV Club.
Yeah.
I'm going to defend them. Those bastards gave me a good review.
Oh, they give...
They reviewed Paleo Cinema Podcast. In fact, Sal gave it to me, and I've got it framed up here.
Oh, wow. I'll have on to the find desk. That.
And just to mess people's heads around, I made it my wallpaper on my computer at work.
Now, the thing we need to check, though, is it pre-purge or post-purge? You know that
of
the AV Club, most of the original writers left to set up the Dissolve.
When did they do that? Approximately. I don't
2 years ago? Year and a half
Well,
ago?
Well, it's slightly over 2 years ago. It was in 2012, I think.
The name I'm looking for is people like Scott Tobias, yes? So, yes.
Okay,
yeah,
it was
2012. It was before the big Onion purge.
Okay, well, I'm bringing it up now because I've got it. I've got it saved here because, of course, you have these things saved on your thing. The date on it is November 9th, 2012.
Yep, I've got it in front of me.
Yep, there you go. And I'm down there in Outliers. It's got a big picture of Tig Notaro on it.
I love Paleo Cinema, though. I've got to, I've run behind on it, sadly, but
Me too.
I've just loved. I think I listened to the Warren Oates episode.
Yeah, I mean Warren Oates was someone. He was one of the actors that I really wanted to talk about, which is one of the reasons why I did the podcast.
Yeah.
People like him and Burt Lancaster.
Oh,
haven't got around to Jeff Chandler yet, but I will.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Jeff Chandler would be an interesting one.
Yeah. So what I'm planning is for future episodes, and this is all extraneous to what we're doing right now, but I'm going to keep it in anyway, is I'm going to be doing more episodes that are dedicated to one actor. Because I find it easier to do.
Yeah, but also what I've found in the episodes I've heard where you've done that, or you've watched both versions of The Killers, you've unearthed all these great backstories about the production and where the cast were at that particular time in their career, and you know what may have made them perform in the film, or what the film did for them, etc.
And the other thing I'm getting into at the moment, and IMDb helps me out a lot, is finding out where the location shooting is done on films. There are so many different films that are all shot around the same part of Southern California.
Oh, it's crazy. Well, the Bronson Canyon's the famous one.
Yeah. But there's places like the Alabama Hills where you can pretend it's anywhere.
Wow.
All of the old Randolph Scott Westerns were filmed around there. And then as soon as I saw the start of Django Unchained, I went Alabama Hills, and sure, it was.
I know exactly. You get to
know the locations, which is kind of cool. Bronson Canyon's like that. Vasquez Rocks is another one. All of these locations are really familiar. It's like when I did go to the States once in '98, and I was in a taxi heading up to Hollywood from the really stupidly chosen hotel down near the airport that I chose.
Right.
In Inglewood. I don't recommend anyone stays at Inglewood. And I'm jet-lagged to hell. I'm not sure where I'm going and why, but I've decided I want to go up to Hollywood. It's just on evening, and we just cruise past Century City, and I see the building from Die Hard. And it spun my head around like you wouldn't believe. I was suddenly in a movie. And that was my first real big experience of feeling like that, that you're in a movie set.
Yeah.
And it's just such, I mean, if you don't know movies and you're not really familiar with them, you're not going to have that fun. It's the kind of joy that only movie buffs ever get.
I remember spending some time in Vancouver. This would have been late 80s, actually, and now, and through the 90s, seeing X-Files and things like that and going, I know exactly where that is. It's very strange. It's very disorientating.
It's like going through Central Park and you realize, yeah, that's where Buddy Ebsen and Audrey Hepburn sat talking in Central Park
in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, we live in a movie-drenched world. And you can even do it seeing things like The Man from Hong Kong, where they film parts of it in the alley next to the State Theatre. And seeing Roger Ward and Sammo Hung have a kung fu fight on the top of Uluru.
There was a Jackie Chan film called, is it Mr. Nice Guy?
Which was filmed around Melbourne, yeah.
Filmed around Melbourne and Brisbane.
Mm.
And there's a scene with him in his Brisbane apartment overlooking the beach. And you're going, what?
Yeah, that doesn't really happen because Brisbane's on a swampy river.
And the fight he had in, it's not exactly a car chase, is it? He's running up and down what is meant to be one street in Melbourne, and it's actually like two or three. It was Swanston Street and Collins Street and Elizabeth Street, I think.
Yeah.
And he passed,
which are parallel.
Yeah, which are parallel, and he passed Batman Records.
Cool.
I remember that.
There's a nice Vietnamese fur bar in Swanson Street, which still has pictures of Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan eating there up on the walls. And it's great for, you know, $8 you can get a full meal there. It's fantastic. But, yeah, we're drifting aside again, and we're getting a little bit silly. So just to summarize, see Detention, even if you're not into teen movies, you're not into slasher films, it's a science fiction movie as well. And even though it may take a little while to get your head into it, it is a lot of fun.
It is. You've just got to not take any preconceptions with you about what type of film it is.
Yeah.
If the first 5 minutes doesn't win you, where you would be I think it's a great way to start a film with a character directly addressing the audience. Yeah,
being basically like a teenage girl, Ferris Bueller bitch, self-admitted bitch.
Yeah,
A really unpleasant character that you want to strangle, but you don't have to.
And I really think it must hold the record for the most movies within a movie.
Oh, it's definitely getting there. It's got, I mean, I'm thinking of some other movies that it references. Things like Saw get referenced in the movie.
Yeah, but just the scene where they're trying to work out the killer.
Mm. And
they know, so they need to see the end of a film that has not finished production yet.
Yeah, and they find a way to do that while they're sitting in detention.
That's right.
Yeah, there's all those kind of things. It is a very cool film. I'm not too sure Joseph Kahn's going to have a career doing much more than music videos. He doesn't look like he's going to be trying for that. But if every 3 or 4 years he came out with a project like this, it'd be a really cool thing.
It would be fabulous. It would just it's just such a it's a one off. Really, I can't think of a film that's like it. The closest thing I can think of that's like it in spirit is Community. But even then, it doesn't really give you a sense of what detention is like. And it's such a neglected film. It's such a film that I think it really is that cult film, a film that not many people know about. And it's very divisive. If you look at Rotten Tomatoes, I was looking at Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic, and you get a lot of reviews at either end of the spectrum.
Yeah. And even the 63 reviews of it on IMDb as well.
Yeah.
And people are saying it's absolutely the best movie from the Seattle International Film Festival. Fast-paced one, too cool for school. There are a lot of good reviews there for it, which is kind of surprising. You usually get mixed reviews on IMDb, but the reviews I can see here are all pretty much positive. And even though you and I are both somewhat out of the demographic for this film, let's be honest about it, you can just let go and have a bit of fun. It's one of those movies that if it had have come out in the 80s, it would have been one of those Village Roadshow movies in the blue covers on VHS.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's got that kind of feel about it. Movies like Wacko and all those silly, don't quite do it right, slasher comedy kind of things from the 1980s. It's very much got a little bit of feel about that about it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of a perfect VHS movie in a time where we don't have VHS movies anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely got that kind of aesthetic about it, which is kind of cool. Anyway, I'm going to wrap this up because we're an hour and 20 minutes
into
our chat. But about an hour and 10 minutes of that is the podcast, so that's all good. But anyway, I'm going to get you back on, okay? You're going to be in the regular cast if that's okay.
That would be terrific. It's great talking to you, Terry.
Yeah, and I'll pick the movie next time. We might kind of swap it.
Yep.
You pick one, I pick one.
Yep.
And get into it. Thank you very much for that. And just plug your website again.
Okay, it's twitter.com, TWEATRE, a cross between Twitter and theatre, twitter.com.
And the other one we talked about is moviesandbacon.com.
Moviesandbacon.com.
Which I've got up here now.
You've got it up?
Yeah, the last review is War Games, John Badham's War Games. So that shows you the kind of movie website it is. Anyway, thanks a lot, Ian. I'll do a little bit of feedback after we finish this.
Fantastic.
And you're not coming down for the convention, are you?
Sadly not. There's another convention I go to, but we're hoping to make Continuum maybe next year. There's just a conflict.
Well, I'll be there because it's close by.
Of course.
Okay, well, take care, and I'll catch up with you later.
Catch up with you later. Thanks very much, Terry.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. And that's about it for this time around. I don't have any feedback, so I better think of a good question to ask people so that I can hang some feedback off it. So here's the question. What is your go-to science fiction, horror, or fantasy movie that you want, when you get a good friend, you want to introduce them to, that they might not have seen before? I'll probably phrase that really badly. So what's your best movie that you like introducing other people to in the genre that maybe is a little unfamiliar to them, a little bit obscure, a little bit out of the way? Tell me what that one is, and we'll start a little chat about it. Anyway, that's about it. I'm going to be going to Continuum 10 this weekend, the National Science Fiction Convention here in Melbourne. I'm commuting, and I'm doing two panels, one on Friday at 8 p.m., which is probably going to be over before this gets published, where I'm talking about silent science fiction movies from the silent era. And then there's a podcasting panel on Sunday. So I hope to see a whole bunch of people there, hang out with them, chat, drink, eat, and discuss genre works. So that's about it. I'll be back in another 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. So keep watching the skies, and I'll see you then.